From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. HP, two letters that signify much more. Hewlett-Packard is the world's largest technology company. It ships 1 million printers a week, nearly that number of PCs. Its revenue forecast for 2010, $118 billion. Probably every schoolchild in the Bay Area learns that HP started out in a one-car garage in downtown Palo Alto. But how did it grow from garage size to gargantuan and survive all the tumultuous times in between? That's part of the story told in a new book called The HP Phenomenon. We'll talk with author Chuck House about HP and the famous HP Way after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In 1939, Walt Disney placed an order to a small Palo Alto company. The order was for 9 oscillators to be used in helping to create the soundtrack for the movie Fantasia. The bill, $517.50. It was the first big order for a company that came to be known by 2 initials, HP, Hewlett-Packard. Hewlett-Packard began in that now fabled garage on Addison Avenue in Palo Alto, the creation of William Hewlett and David Packard. 70 years later, Hewlett-Packard is the world's largest technology company, operating in 170 countries, employing over 300,000 people. Hewlett-Packard has also long been known for its culture, the celebrated HP Way. But it has also engendered and endured enormous transformation and plenty of tumultuous times. Chuck House was part of the engineering and management team at HP for many years, and he's now co-authored, along with Raymond Price, a new book about Hewlett-Packard called The HP Phenomenon, Innovation and Business Transformation. Chuck House is also a senior research scholar at Stanford University, and he joins us this morning on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, how are you? Glad to be here.
Happy to have you with us. I want to start with sort of a big, obvious, impossible question, which is, why does HP matter? I mean, sure, it employs 300,000 people, operates in 170 countries, as I just described. But at this moment in time, we've just spent an hour talking about the woes of the economy and the problems of job creation. Why does HP matter?
Well, I think HP probably matters most, Dave, because it's one of the most innovative companies sort of over a long historic period that you can point to in American history. And what I mean by that isn't so much that it was inventive, but it was able to renew itself time and time again. And we looked at, for example, those oscillators led to a whole capability in radio. And then they moved into microwave. And then they moved into medical devices. And then they moved into chemistry. They moved into pocket calculators. They moved into printing. And now they're into services. There's no other company in American history that has had its major product line be different every decade of its existence.
And is that way of thinking, do you think, particularly relevant now, that now is a time when
absolutely.
You can't be trapped inside?
Absolutely. Let me look at an example. The Council on Competitiveness, you know, appointed by President Reagan, has been in business 25 years. They say they're helping American. The last 5 leaders, if you take their companies, collectively those companies have lost half their jobs, half their profits, and haven't made a dollar extra in revenue in the last decade. You say, we should be listening to that? You know, let's look at a company that grows. Let's look at a company that produces jobs. And why does that happen? That's the relevant question.
Right. So let's talk about the whys,
okay,
and the particulars of what has allowed Hewlett-Packard to go from those 9 oscillators that helped make the soundtrack for the movie Fantasia to this big sprawling company today that employs hundreds of thousands of people. I know there are many aspects to this, but identify what you think is the key ingredient.
I think the key ingredient is caught on 2 elements. One is it was a bottoms-up company rather than top-down. One way of saying that is Packard, who was an imposing and wonderful father figure, opposed every single shift. And this is kind of amazing. How could the leader say, no, don't go there? And yet the company went there. And what he let the market decide. He let the kids have the power and let the market decide.
So in each of those transitions that you're talking about, going from making oscillators and instrumentation to printers or whatever came next,
right,
in that chain of progression of products, David Packard was saying, no, don't do that?
It was amazing. The book opens with, I got the Medal of Defiance for producing something. He absolutely commanded, don't do that. Later, he said that'd be a great example for the entrepreneurs around the country. The laser jet was done by the same guy who did three successive failures over 10 years. And yet, the time he says, I think I now have it, they gave him the keys to the vault.
Tell that story. You mentioned getting the medal, but you were part of a team of people that created an early computer screen, right? A monitor, and Packard came to look at it. Describe what happened.
Well, we had annual meetings at every division. I was in the Colorado Springs division, so they flew out from Palo Alto. They looked at this thing. The market forecast from the marketing director was 31 units or something like that. This is at a time teletypes were all that you could do to interact with computers. And he told them, not me, he said, when I come back next year, I don't want to see that product in the lab, which I heard the next morning. I said, well, if it's in production, how would that be? And my boss said, sure, you're on. You can't do that. And we had it in production. He came back the next year. He says, what's this thing doing on the market? I thought I said to kill it. And I said, no, sir, all you said was you didn't want to see it in the lab. It's not.
And he gave you the Medal of Defiance, which what was it for? I forget the quote, but it was for contempt and defiance.
Extraordinary contempt and defiance of the company founder.
Chuck House is our guest this hour, along with Raymond Price. He's written a book called The HP Phenomenon, Innovation and Business Transformation. With these transformations, and you're saying that part of what made that possible was their willingness to sort of push things to the lowest order. And that also goes along with what seems to be a key component of what's become known as the HP way, which is to hire really smart people. How crucial was that in terms of how this company has continued to flourish?
Oh, I think that's an extraordinary part of it, Dave. We hired at key universities. We hired engineers for most jobs. The scientific background of most of our people in most of the management positions, whether it was in quality or manufacturing or HR even, all came out of engineering circles. So the technologies we were using could be understood all over the company. And what that meant was if you've got a kind of a radical idea, and Packard might be saying, I'm really unsure about this, or I'm quite sure we shouldn't be doing it, you could find sponsors elsewhere who would say, well, let's give this another chance. It looks like it could make some sense. And so you got some breathing room. It wasn't that all the company ran that way, but it was that crazy ideas could go far enough and could be nurtured long enough by some supporters that you had rope.
One of the other components of their approach also seemed to be, you mentioned having things decided at a lower level and delegation to really smart, able people. But it's also decentralized.
Seems
to be another kind of key ingredient. Speak to why that mattered and why that perhaps might still be a relevant lesson for American business today.
I think there's two things. One is if you're somewhere else, you learn things that happen there rather than what happens here. And so if you've got a decentralized company, when I came back to Palo Alto and was running some of the coordination between different laboratories, we had R&D labs in 91 locations in 26 states and nations. So you learn what's going on in Bangalore, India, 20 years before others do. You learn what's going on in Japan or China. We were the first company into China with an R&D lab. These kinds of things give you a perspective. Geneva, we were in Geneva with our financial calculator, discovered to our shock and amazement they have a 360-day year. Our question was, where do the other 5 days go?
And you were also in, as you know, Colorado Springs and Corvallis, Oregon. And some people might look at that and say, well, doesn't that mean that there's a lot of duplication going on? You don't have enough of a coordinated approach.
I think the feeling always has been the motivation you get from people having charge and responsibility outweighs the inefficiency you have of duplication of effort. So we put a thin overlay of coordination in place and a heavy dose of independent action. And you kind of let the market decide. And the rule was if two groups are doing roughly the same thing, the marketplace decides which wins, and the other team is supposed to sort of gracefully withdraw from the field. Only failed once, and that was when both the laser jet and the inkjet printers were wildly successful. They wound up relatively competitive with each other. But in general, one team won, and the other team just found something else to do.
One of the aspects of the HP way, as it's often referred to, are things that engender a lot of company loyalty. And I'd like to ask you about that. One thing that was striking to me is you reference a number of times in the book the HP alumni or alumni association.
Sure.
I think of alumni, you usually think of that word in association with colleges or universities, or perhaps people have that sort of intense feeling about once having served in the military. Is there something about HP that engenders that same sense of loyalty, that same sense of this was a truly profound identifying, identity-building sort of experience?
Oh, I think so. Most divisions had a, you know, your division was your company. You didn't think of Palo Alto. If you were in Colorado Springs, you worked together, you had picnics together, you had just a host of activities together. It was a family. It was kind of we were the only game in town in our kind of technology. So our friends and neighbors often were our associates, and it just became a very close team. And I think that happened all over the world.
And
HP.
What was it that allowed that sort of loyalty to be fostered? Was it the fact that there were health benefits early on, much earlier than many companies, profit sharing, that kind of thing? What were the key elements that allowed that?
I think the biggest thing was that Dave and Bill in particular, but I think CEOs thereafter, had this innate belief in the dignity of the individual. It didn't matter what job level you had, you mattered as a person. And so you could make decisions from any job area that could change the company. So the order processing system was invented basically by kids that just came out of school. They weren't asked to do it. They weren't told to do it. They thought of it and given the power to radically change the whole way we ran the MIS function.
Those ingredients are things that you almost think would be best inculcated in a smaller company. And, of course, today Hewlett-Packard is the largest high-tech company in the world. What are the challenges to maintaining that kind of loyalty as you grow?
Well, first of all, you've got to have a belief that the people do matter. So the trust and the respect and the mutual recognition of that function is vital. And not everybody learns that. You know, the business schools teach efficiency of operations. They teach a pretty streamlined approach to life. And so it's easy to find in most companies, I think, a much more impersonal view of how to run these things. They aren't run as our team. They're run as cogs in a wheel. And I think the larger the company gets, the more subject it is to that kind of pressure anyway.
The company, though, has gone through, obviously, a lot of difficult times, and we'll talk about some of those as our conversation progresses. But what elements of the company have allowed the company to respond, I guess, to difficult times, or have there? There are a lot of people who would say that the HP way is gone, no more, it's faded away.
You know, we hear that all the time. I would say most of my colleagues would agree with that statement and would say, hey, it's dead, dead, dead. But what's fascinating is we would interview, for the book, we interviewed 500 or 600 people, including virtually every ex-officer. And we'd have two people who met and worked at HP and married. And now their son or daughter's there and maybe that spouse. And so we're all four at the table, and the two elders are explaining the HP way is dead, irretrievably lost. And the two kids are looking at the parents saying, well, what do you mean? It's a great place. I'm loving it. You know, I've been at other places here in the valley, as big or smaller, and this is terrific. And the next thing you know, you've got a family of discussion going on. What do you mean? So I think it's all relative. It has to do with how is your job function serving a satisfaction and a fun quotient, how much responsibility do you have? And if you feel good about that, you can like a company that's quite large because your own unit, you have value.
David Packard was famous for espousing so-called management by walking around. How do you walk around when there are 300,000 employees?
Well, that's a trick. You know, I'm not sure Mark Hurd even has an idea of how many places there are to walk around to these days. Packard tasked me with a job one time of getting to every R&D facility once a year. And this was when we had 91, and then it kind of grew and grew. We had about 125. Well, you're on the road all the time. So, you know, it becomes somewhat impractical. But that's where some of these virtual technologies allow much more high touch, even though it's a virtual touch. It takes a lot of effort to maintain that feeling of closeness.
Do you think that's still relevant, Chuck House? Again, as we think about this challenging economic time that we're in, that touch matters?
Touch matters indisputably. Yeah, we work a lot at Stanford with these video immersion systems. We also work with a lot of the social networking capabilities. I am continually amazed by how much more magic there is when you get people in a room. For the social back chatter, all of the things that really build trust. Where'd you go to school? Where'd you grow up? Oh, you were on a baseball team. You know, all these things that basically fill in the niches that say, oh, I can believe in you. And then you know, once you've got that mutual trust, then you can do things together without having to continually question.
Chuck House, our guest this hour. He's a senior scholar at Stanford University and has written a book along with Raymond Price called The HP Phenomenon, Innovation and Business Transformation. HP was slow in some areas in recognizing things that were upon them, the computer being one of them. You tell the story of how they famously turned down Steve Wozniak of Apple fame, who wanted to bring them the idea of the PC. Walk us through first why the company was skeptical about personal computing in particular.
Well, maybe I could go back to why computing in particular.
Yeah.
Packard was skeptical because he said IBM's our biggest customer. And there at the time, there's the seven dwarfs and IBM. And why would we want to get into something where companies as big as GE and RCA are struggling? Bear in mind, we were like 1/90th the size of an IBM. We got in it because the voltmeter got digitized. And it could make 6 readings a second, and no technician could write that fast. And so the question was, how do you do it? So we built a data logger, which happened to be the 2116 computer. But we called it an instrument controller rather than a computer. It's delicious. When we got into personal computers, our view was that a personal computer would mostly be valuable for scientists. We weren't looking at it as a hobbyist or a home market or something like that. We were looking at it for engineers and chemists and people like that. And we'd already built the 9100, which was a personal computer, had every attribute you would talk about today for what came out as, the Apple II or something like that. In fact, Wozniak worked on those at HP long before he went to found Apple. So we thought we were in the personal computer business. But this notion of a consumer base just wasn't HP's forte. So it wasn't that we were opposed to the technology. It was that we were opposed to the market space.
And is this another example of something that Hewlett and Packard resisted initially?
Oh, sure. Yeah, very good example. Now, there's a fun story around the HP 35, which was the first handheld calculator for HP, a little scientific calculator. Hewlett fell in love with it. The entire company was opposed to it. When SRI did a market study that said this will not sell more than 1,000 units. It was a $400 handheld device when $50, four-function calculators were on the market from Japan already. And so SRI said, can't sell. I met the guy who did the report about 3 weeks ago, just serendipitously. So that was a great story. But the point was, we put it on the market. We had 1,600 products in the catalog at the time. We'd been in business 32 years. No product sold more than 10 units a day. So we were a giant job shop to specialists. This product within 5 months is selling 1,000 units a day. But HP around the world had no place they could take cash on a transaction. So we had a guy in France who gave out over 100 machines across the counter in the Paris sales office. He dropped dead and they found from a heart attack, and they found over 100 checks in his desk drawer that he didn't know what to do with. That he took from these people. I mean, so it completely threw the company for a loop to be in businesses that it wasn't aligned to.
And what can we learn from the fact that was resisted? They were late in getting into the game, trailed a lot of other companies when it came to PCs in particular, but managed to sort of incorporate that in the end.
Well, I think HP's always been a slow growth, late to market company in almost every product line it's gotten into. And that was one of the surprises, I think, for people in the research we did.
And is that smart? I mean, is because we think now about this time in our first hour of forum, we talked about the need to continuously innovate, and we have to innovate, and that's going to be the solution in the future.
I would distinguish between invent and innovate.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, when they use the word innovate, mean invent. You know, first mover advantage. You know, you've got to do the kind of thing that Steve Jobs does so well with Apple is invent and then innovate behind that. Innovate really means to build a strong enough base, in my mind, that you begin to own the market. And of these six areas HP went into, they wound up dominating almost all of them or catching the leader, even though they got in 10 to 15 to 20 years late.
And why is that? Is that because they got the details right, the operation right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that sounds a little trite, but the focus always was on contribution. So let me use the laser jet, which a lot of people know, you know, the early printers. So the printer was invented. The Computer History Museum will show it was invented at Xerox Rochester in 1969. Xerox didn't want it. Gary Starkweather went somewhere else. IBM, 7 years later, put it out at $500,000. Xerox Park then reacted with Gary back on the team there, did one at $350,000. We did one 3 years later at $90,000, thinking it would sell 75 a month. First month was zero, second month zero, third month zero, the fourth month they sold one. And so at the 10th anniversary, some wag said, and thus began the great printer revolution at HP. But what we did is we drove that $90,000 price tag, which was one-fourth of what was on the available from IBM and Xerox, two powerhouses at the time. We drove it from $90,000 to $3,500 in 4 years.
And you cite a number of examples like that in the book about how those challenges would say, okay, this is great, but now let's see how we can do it for 10 times less the cost.
Right, right. And I think that's the innovative piece is they just continually drove that price envelope or the feature envelope in radical ways.
And that's another part of this that seems critically important, though perhaps obvious, which was Packard in particular seems to have had this dictum, if we're going to be in it, we're going to be the best.
Yeah.
We're going to be
number
one. And it had to be approached in that manner.
Yeah, the one that was so famous for HP was we'd been in computing 15 years. He'd been resistant the whole time. We said, we've got to do something different. And the idea was to hire the chief engineer from IBM, who was dissatisfied there. We weren't trying to poach him as much as he was dissatisfied. And Dave said, well, if you're going to do that, we have to become number one in computing. And the company was incredulous. We're 14th in America. We're 25th in the world. We're 1/30th the size of IBM after being in the business 15 years. They thought he was crazy.
And the other part of this, of course, lest this all sound soft and warm and fuzzy, is that Packard was also always insistent that it's got to make money. I mean, profit is key.
Oh, Dave was soft and warm and fuzzy wasn't the way we described him.
Chuck House, our guest this hour. He mentioned the Computer History Museum. I should also mention that Chuck will be at the Computer History Museum Monday at 7 o'clock. I'll be there as well to moderate a discussion. So if you'd like to learn more about HP and the HP phenomenon, that'll be an opportunity to do so at the Computer History Museum Monday at 7 o'clock. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls as well. If you're an HP alum or someone who currently is there, what are your thoughts about the HP way, about where it's come from and where it's going in the future? We'd like to hear from you. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Back with more in just a moment. This is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the HP phenomenon and the so-called HP way. Chuck House is our guest. He's a senior scholar at Stanford University and has written, along with Raymond Price, a book about Hewlett-Packard called The HP Phenomenon, Innovation and Business Transformation. Chuck House will also be at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View Monday at 7 o'clock. I'll be there as well to moderate a discussion about HP and to give an audience a chance to listen in and ask questions. So if you're interested in attending that, that'll be at the Computer History Museum Monday at 7 o'clock in Mountain View. We Welcome your calls about the HP phenomenon, your questions about the company's history, its growth, and its future. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your questions at forum at kqed.org. That's forum at kqed.org. And let's go to our first caller. Maureen joins us from Rockland this morning. Maureen, go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I am an HP spouse of 30 years. My husband retired from HP after 30 years. And we spent 92 to 96 in Beijing. And we were at that, I don't know what the politically correct term is, but we were the only Caucasians working at HP China at that time. And David Packard came over to visit. And Hewlett Packard was very innovative in that they had built apartments for their employees and then allowed them to buy them from Hewlett Packard. And David Packard insisted on going to see these apartments and visiting. So this is a story about the cogs in the wheel. And he went to visit in the apartment, and one of the employees had an aquarium, which he was very proud of. And David Packard looked at the aquarium and said, "Oh, I have one of those." And, of course, the employee had no idea that he was talking about the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And so he said, "I'll send you either a video or a book about this aquarium." And so, lo and behold, he and Shirley did do that.
Great story.
Maureen, that is terrific. And I think that shows something about those two founders, the fact that he would take time out on a trip like that to say, "I'd like to see your home."
And it also reminds me of Maureen, thanks so much for the call. Great, great story. It reminds me of another story you tell about David Packard, about how he anticipated the fall of the Berlin Wall because of something he noticed. He sounds like someone who noticed a lot.
Packard noticed a lot, and I think Maureen just captured it with that aquarium story. But he this was before the Berlin Wall fell, and he stood up in front of the HP General Managers meeting and told us we had to start thinking about this coming down and how would we respond to the new market the Eastern Bloc might represent. And somebody asked him after the meeting, that must be because you were in the Defense Department. He said, "Well, I was in our Vienna office and I was reading the telephone log and I was just counting how many calls came in from the East Bloc and they went up by tenfold last year." He says, "Something must be happening."
So paying attention. I mean, part of walking, it's not just walking around, it's paying attention.
Yeah, it was paying attention while walking around.
And to Hugh in Oakland. Hugh, go ahead.
So you had mentioned the HP way and responsibilities to employees, which transcend generations. And I'd like your comments on how this carries over to their philanthropic efforts and their families' efforts. You mentioned the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which goes two generations, and I think that they also have in Colorado Springs an attachment to Colorado College, which might even transcend three generations, and one of the best science programs of any liberal arts college in the country because of the Packards.
Are you a Colorado College alum?
I am, unfortunately, not in the science area, but CC is very proud of the connection, and some of my friends went through it was very well known that they were working on Packard-funded microscopes and stuff like that.
Well, let me embellish that a bit. David Packard's father and mother met there and married right afterward. And I found the 1902 yearbook. He was born in 1912. I found the 1902 yearbook, and Dave's father was described as being the most melancholy man on campus, and the mother was described as the most vivacious girl. And they said this will be some match.
Hugh, thanks for the call. It also brings to mind something that you touch on in the book as well, which was that civic life and civic contributions was something that Packard and Hewlett both valued. Both, of course, have continued through their foundations after their deaths to continue that contribution. But that was key.
That was very key. And the point they made, and this caused early consternation. Dave got in trouble at a Stanford event in 1942 when he said a corporation has responsibility to the community. And the shareholder groups and the business school challenged that pretty hard. He stayed with that his whole life. And his point was, if you live in a community and you're proud of the company you work for, he says you just have a different bearing and a different attitude than if you're not.
You also tell an interesting story about his willingness to pay property taxes.
Oh, that was a great one. May I extend that? So 1963, he bought a 33-acre piece of ground in Los Altos Hills, which at that time wasn't much of a town. And his tax attorney got with the county assessor, who said you could use the Williamson Act to really cut down, which was an agricultural exemption act, to cut your taxes dramatically from a residential place to an agricultural place. He came back and said, you know, we don't want to do that. And the reason is we discovered the taxes go to support the local schools and the local fire department. We want to carry our fair share.
Here's a comment, and I'm not surprised to get this, and important that we speak to, lest this become a complete HP love fest over the next 20 minutes. But this listener writes in, the HP that your guest is talking about is not the HP of today. I'm an ex-HP employee. I left on my own. And while there are plenty of smart people in specific areas of the company, the truth is that today HP is only a behemoth who uses its bigness to push deals and acquire other companies. There isn't anything innovative coming out of HP anymore. While your guest is inspirational, his comments are mostly nostalgic.
I hear that a lot. I hear that primarily from my colleagues and friends. I heard it from a lot of the interviewees. And at one level, I believe it. At another level, though, I have to say we've been stunned, not just surprised, stunned by a large number of people that say, not in our division, not in our group. It's still the HP that it was. There's a lot of angst. There's a lot of anger. There are a lot of parts of HP that are dysfunctional today, no question about that. And it is run as a behemoth. I would certainly support the caller on that. But I must say, we had a Kepler's meeting in Menlo Park, a bookstore signing, and like seven people in a row came along with exactly that point of view of our write-in caller. And the next person came up in tears and says, I work there now, and I just have to tell you, that misses the point of what's happening in my department. This is still a great place. So it's a mixed bag. Now, it always was that way. When the computer group took over from the instrument group, the instrument people were absolutely enraged. The HP way is gone forever. This is 1975. Well, so it has somewhat to do with your perspective.
Let's talk a little bit about a particularly tumultuous time, which was 10 years ago when Carly Fiorina came in as the new CEO. And shortly thereafter, there were layoffs. It was the time when the dot-com industry was going bust in the early part of 2000-2001. Then the Compaq merger, which was highly controversial and which more people wound up losing jobs. A lot of bitterness. Fiorina, of course, in the end, forced out by the board a number of years later. How do you look back at that time and whether or not, because many people point to that saying,
that's when we lost it.
That's when HP Way went away.
Well, Lou Platt was one of my favorite friends and people.
Who was the CEO before
Fiorina. Who was forced out before Fiorina came in. He probably did more to promote the HP Way in the people-friendly manner than even Dave or Bill did. But he lost sight, or the company lost sight during his tenure, of strategic value. And the reason she was brought in was to try and restore that. In doing so, there was HP had really missed the dot-com boom. And it was a tumultuous time, but it was tumultuous for most companies out there. And I would have to say my assessment is that she saved the company in terms of the nameplate. The company would have been dismembered, much like Agilent was. Most of Agilent has been taken apart and sold off in the meantime.
And you also feel that in the end, the Compaq merger was the right thing.
I think it worked. They put, and it was people like Webb McKinney, you know, old HP veterans who put a cultural merge in place that even someone like Ned Barnholt, one of the staunch, who was CEO of Agilent at the time, a 35-year HP veteran, said, I've never seen anything done so well to try and merge those two cultures. So that worked. Now, her style caused a lot of personal angst for people, and that – I think that kind of thing and Mark's, I would say, somewhat uncharismatic approach to life.
Mark Hurd, the current CEO.
Those have not engendered the kind of positive emotional feelings that historically were associated with HP.
And back to our callers. Ken, or rather Jim in Palo Alto, joins us next. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, I have heard that HP was rather late in the Big Brother game to introduce drug testing, which let the company become an all-knowing father about people's medical needs and what people did off hours. And what did that do specifically to the atmosphere of trust and respect that they had enjoyed before?
Jim, thanks for the call.
I'm going to probably take the fifth on that one. I was at HP for a long time, but I left in 91, and I didn't find anything about that particular topic. So I'm sorry. I'm going to have to duck that one.
And to Ken in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ken, go ahead.
Hello. I'm a longtime user of Hewlett Packard products over 40 years in broadcasting and television production. And now that I'm retired, I swear by Hewlett Packard. And anytime Hewlett Packard comes out with a product that I can use, I'll buy.
Ken,
I love
you. That's great.
Thanks for the call and the observation. You talk about how quality became such a big issue in American industry over the past, I don't know, 10, 20 years, I suppose, and that's part of something that also needs to be focused on when you look at the HP phenomenon, that there was a focus on quality of products that Ken is describing.
Well, and it came out of HP's instrument heritage, and the belief was if you build an instrument for somebody to make a measurement in something they're doing that's valuable, whether it's a medical situation or an electronic situation, you have to trust the instrument. And the example Dave would always use is if a doctor put a thermometer in your mouth and it came out reading 103, you don't ask, I wonder if the thermometer's wrong. You know, so the point was you have got to make very high quality stuff for the niche that we were in with our products.
A couple of people are challenging on the question of labor. Elmo writes in, could you ask your guests to address how HP is shipping manufacturing jobs to China and uses cheap labor to make computers super cheap and therefore avoids paying taxes? So challenging what HP is doing in terms of taking advantage of low-wage earners in China and other countries.
Well, first of all, that's a phenomenon going on all over the globe, and American multinationals have, in some respects, been leading that charge. HP is much less so than most of its equivalent competitors. The current Business Week story that said, looked at the numbers for IBM, and they were shocking even to me. The thing that I think is interesting about HP's move abroad in general is we have, generally speaking, moved kind of a holistic unit. We'll have the R&D there and the marketing. So it isn't just the low-paying jobs. It's the talent base that allows you to be indigenously able to produce products that serve those markets.
But can the sort of loyalty that we were talking about before, the culture of employees matter, in this environment that we currently live in, how does HP extend that philosophy so that they're not just taking advantage of low-wage workers overseas?
That's actually a tough question for me to give you a quick answer. I don't have a good answer to that. The thing that I've noticed with HP is they have basically moved more to an outsourcing model where they rely on other manufacturers. So they're more of an engineering and marketing company today than they are a vertically integrated company.
But
those jobs, which are outsourced, even though they're with other companies, those jobs by and large have left the States.
But you wouldn't disagree that it's a particular challenge to maintain the HP way, to value employees and be consistent about that, to not be hypocritical about that. Given,
absolutely.
Yeah,
that's a very hard thing. And I think the point you had in the previous hour that, we're at 12% unemployment rate in the Bay Area, the most innovative center on the globe. What's going on?
What would David Packard say to that question, do you think, if he were alive today, or Bill Hewlett? I mean, what would they say?
I think they'd want to know what the contribution is we can make that would make those jobs be here.
And what would it be?
What would those contributions be?
Yeah, I mean, well, how would they try
I
to...
I think they would say, how come we didn't move faster? How come companies like this aren't more impactful in the greenfield area, aren't more impactful in healthcare? We've got a healthcare crisis in this country that we see Washington mired in. You know, where are the plays on that? You know, Dave helped start Genentech, believing that's the place to go. We had a joint venture with Genentech and HP in 1983.
And back to our callers, Robin in Napa. Robin, go ahead.
Hi, I had two anecdotes. One is a reminiscence from when I used to live in Big Sur in the 70s, late 70s. At a little inn, and the Packards had and still have, I believe, a beautiful piece of property on the ocean side across the street. And they used to come for breakfast once in a while and bring us apricots from their tree. And just lovely, sweet people. And then I remember I was there when they funded their daughter to start the aquarium, and it was a great gift to the community that still goes on today. So I have very fond memories of them. And they were very unassuming people. Coincidentally, I just had an HP experience yesterday, which I don't usually have because I don't have a lot of interface with the computers. But, I mean, I use one every day, but, you know, it's rare that I have to call about it. So I wanted to give a perspective of the HP way and what about the does it extend, or obviously not, to the end user? So I had to call tech support because a friend of mine had given me a printer. She got a new one, and I have an old one, so she gave me her HP printer, and I had to call customer service because she could not give me the CD to install it. And I looked all over the web, and I couldn't find the right driver for the printer.
And Robin, sorry to interject, but if you would just come to the end point of the story, please.
Well, after spending half an hour with tech support, the man would not simply tell me the answer to where I could find the driver on the website because I gave him the serial number, and he said, oh, your tech support is expired. I can't tell you that.
You're kidding.
No. After spending an hour, and he was in a foreign country, I could hear that. But he wouldn't give me that simple piece of information, and that makes me feel like I never want to buy another HP product again. So the HP way has to extend to the people who use the products.
Robin, thanks. Thanks for the call and point.
Let me build on that a bit. My wife, who I met at HP and is an HP loyalist, is using an HP printer heavily for her small business. And it has broken three times in the last year. And this gal is so frustrated with the current quality of these machines that I don't think she would buy another one right now either. I didn't say that on air, did I?
Yes, you did. And Lou in Millbrae wants to extend the not all is roses. Oh, sorry. Lou, we'll get to you in just a moment. We just switched to Jim in Menlo Park. Jim, go ahead.
Thanks for having me on. Just one point and then a question. I too, believe that building of the individual and responsibility and respect at HP was just a phenomenal thing. I was there in the late 70s. And it's really sad how you don't really see that so much in Silicon Valley and other companies. There are some, but that respect for individual innovation that Hewlett and Packard put together is just really the key to my certainly success. But I wanted to ask Mr. House, I really think that it wasn't so much Lou Platt's situation that got HP off the track a little bit, but sort of the management decisions before Lou and after Hewlett and Packard. And I was just curious what you think they should have done differently in the early 80s that might have made it easier for Lou to have more success.
Jim, thanks for the call. Lou Platt, again, was the CEO in the chronology here. John Young preceded Lou Platt, and then Carly Fiorina.
Well, I'm not quite sure that I share your thinking on that. Lou, I loved, and John and I were, I guess you would say, colleagues, but I wouldn't exactly say friends. But in doing the research on this book, I've been struck strongly by the strategic plans that were put in place under John's care. And it's pretty clear that some of those actually came apart under Lou. So we take that stance in the book, and I think I could take you through that, but we don't have time, obviously, here.
Let's go. I want to get back to another Lou in Millbrae, who also wanted to say that not everything is always rosy at HP. Lou, go ahead.
Yes, with all due respect to your guest, I'm an engineer in the Valley and have continued to work with Hewlett-Packard equipment for many, many years. And one of the biggest things that I see as the failing, especially in the HP way, was when they turned Hewlett-Packard from a real high technology company into what amounts to a computer and printer ink company. The best equipment, test equipment, semiconductors, medical equipment, all of that stuff was being innovatively designed and developed by Hewlett-Packard. And when they rolled the divisions off, like, for instance, they rolled all their frequency and time stuff off into Agilent. Agilent manufactures the worst equipment out there now. And they used to carry the moniker the HP way, and then they took that moniker off, which was very appropriate. And I see a big loss in the engineering and electronics industry from the loss of Hewlett-Packard as it was, because Hewlett-Packard today is nothing like it was when it was a real company making high-tech equipment.
Lou, thanks.
I would probably agree with a great deal of what you say. I'm a little surprised by your comment about the quality of Agilent equipment. I haven't heard as much critique of that as I have of current HP equipment.
A number of people also want to come back, and this isn't surprising either, to the tumultuous times in which Carly Fiorina was the CEO at Hewlett-Packard. Carl writes, it's significant that HP was historically slow to emerge as a market player. As HP's growth slowed, former CEO Carly Fiorina got board approval for the acquisition of Compaq. She was criticized for compromising the HP way and sometime later fired. Please comment on how HP's reinvention process met the challenge of slow growth as its culture changed.
Well, it's kind of interesting. If you look at the end of 1998, HP was cumulatively larger than Apple, Cisco, and Intel put together in terms of revenue. If you look at it today, it's cumulatively larger than those same three companies. And this is pre-iPod, pre-iPhone, the big network centers. So somehow HP's kept it going. Now, some would say that's mostly because they did acquisitions. But, of course, Cisco is built on acquisitions. And HP under Dave Packard was built on acquisitions. So it's a little bit unfair to say acquisitions versus not. HP has – the secret of the fact that it's been able to be successful has been that it's been able to assimilate these and meld them. And the question – in fact, the question we've got running through this is have we lost the HP way in so doing? And many people say, well, sure, but it's not – it can't be the same at $118
right.
billion that it was at $1 billion.
I wonder if to some extent with Carly Fiorina in particular, but perhaps generally, it's not so much – whether a particular decision was right, but the how of it and the way in which it was communicated.
Yeah.
Brian writes in, my close friend was one of HP's top scientists, but left in disgust after 20 years because of the way in which Fiorina was treating good people. So I wonder if to some extent, you know, the Compaq decision may have been the right one, but the how of it, the way in which that was done, is what people are reacting to in terms of both Fiorina, but also the loss of the luster of the HP way.
There was one significant time to me, and that was 2001. Both HP and Agilent faced big layoff pressures, as did a number of other Valley firms. And Fiorina basically dismissed people, and they got a pink slip and escorted out the door that day. And at Agilent, the story was that Ned Barnholt was helping people pack up and walking the stuff to the car with them. And, it spoke volumes about a different approach, kind of the old way versus the new way.
And to William in Portland, Oregon. William, go ahead.
Yes, I've worked for HP for about 20 years, and I wanted to respond to the caller who had such a terrible experience with customer service. Just that the engineers at HP, the people who are designing these products, often think and do think about the customers and think about them in precisely that way. We would like to universalize what used to be the HP way. And I would urge her to make another attempt at tracking down that driver for that printer through the HP website. It's hp.com. There's support and drivers across the top, and she should be able to put in her printer number and come up with a driver right away.
William, thanks. Thanks for the call. Hope you're still listening, the person who had such a trouble with her particular HP printer. We just have a moment or two left, Chuck House, and again, I'm curious about sort of putting all of this in context, given these challenging times. Unemployment numbers out today, better but still daunting, 10% nationwide, 12% here in our area. It feels like we should be doing better, given the high-tech area in which we live and the legacy of David Packard and William Hewlett, and yet we're not. So as you think of the HP phenomenon, what's the nugget from that phenomenon that would be particularly important for us to pay attention to in this time?
I think the thing we've had going through this whole conversation is that HP has moved to being a tops-down, directed company, and you can't run a company in this day and age that way. That the bottoms-up model that the old HP was is more appropriate to the kind of world we have. You've got to be nimble, you've got to be alert, and you've got to be creative with these processes. And to the extent we try to legislate them from a top-down model, it doesn't work. And so I think the old HP is the best model for the 21st century corporations to succeed.
And
but most
still,
of the most of the valley is not there. Most of the valley has adopted more the top-down business model.
And leaders still need to walk around and pay attention.
Must. Thanks very much, Dave, for having me.
Chuck House, our guest this hour, along with Raymond Price. His new book is called The HP Phenomenon, Innovation and Business Transformation. Again, Chuck will be at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View on Monday, December the 7th at 7 o'clock. I'll be there as well to lead the discussion and to take questions from the audience if you're interested in attending. Again, that's 7 o'clock Monday at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Lorberg, and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour, Howard Gelman, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.